Chapter 2, Risk Assessment. Day 1, BV. Before Vampire. Approximately 8 hours before my body lay mangled, bloody, lifeless, and inert on the hardwood floors of Dr. Freenley's office, I was in my own office, ascertaining the untimely demises of any number of unsuspecting victims who were not myself. You see, I work for La Brea Life Insurance. And no, I don't sell life insurance. Contrary to popular belief, socially awkward, miserable, and neurotic folk like me are not exactly salesman material. The only thing I can imagine selling the American public is a bottle of hand sanitizer. While we're on the subject, did you know that using hand sanitizer does not actually protect your hands from germs? Instead, it merely traps those germs in a filmy layer of goo just above your skin. So, the minute you scratch your nose or your eyes, you have just effectively slathered your face with germs. Right. So I guess I won't be selling hand sanitizer anytime soon, either. Here's what I do. I'm an actuary, or risk analyst to you lay folks out there. I'm the one you curse under your breath after being notified that your life insurance premium is roughly equivalent to your monthly salary. Basically, it's my job to calculate, based on a series of complex formulas and variable statistics, the age and manner in which you are most likely to croak. If you are a slow croaker, i.e. someone likely to live a long and happy life, you are entitled to a low insurance premium. Fast croakers, i.e. those who show a high probability of bleeding my employers dry by forcing them to make a hefty payout in a relatively short amount of time, will be wham-bam, no thank you manned with a ridiculously high premium, or worse, a flat-out denial. On the morning in question, I'm at my desk, reviewing yet another mind-numbing pile of life insurance applications. Candidate 1 is a male, age 52, recently divorced with 2 college-aged children. He's a partner in a law firm who's planning to marry wife number 3, a woman half his age, formerly his personal assistant, within the next month. He's also recently purchased a brand spanking new little red Corvette. This midlife crisis with the gold-digging fiancé is an accident waiting to happen. I brand his ass with my trusty red denied stamp, but doing so gives me no joy. Before I can move on to candidate 2, my office phone rings. I briefly consider ignoring it. The last time I received a worthwhile phone call at work was 2 years ago when Ed McMahon called to tell me I won $10 million from the Publishers Clearing House sweepstakes. It ended up being a wrong number. On the slim hope that Publishers Clearing House, but not Ed McMahon himself, unfortunately, R.I.P. Ed McMahon, may be calling again, for real this time, I doubtfully pick up the phone. "Hello, Mr. Blumenstein. Please hold for Harvard Black," intones a sultry female voice on the other end of the line. I'm then subjected to about 10 seconds of hideously head-pounding gangster rap before my brother decides an acceptable length of time has passed and graces me with his multi-million dollar voice. "Jerry," my brother shouts. I hate when people call me Jerry. Judging by the harsh wind noises and tinny, faraway sound of his voice, I can instantly discern that my sibling has called me from his cell phone, undoubtedly while driving with the top down on his Mustang convertible. Cell phone laws and increased risk of death be damned. Nothing can stop Teen Bop Magazine's Sexiest Dude Alive, winner of not one, but 2 of those infamous Razzie Awards. Or, at least, that's what he thinks. I've already turned my baby brother down for a life insurance policy. Twice. Harold, I respond flatly. Two can play at the detested name game. I can almost hear Harvard grimace over the phone at my mention of the name listed on his birth certificate. Oh, listen, bro. I need to ask you a favor, he wheedles. Shocker, I mutter under my breath as I absentmindedly twirl the phone cord around my fingertips. My brother is 8 years my junior, but thanks to good genes that never found their way into the fertilized egg and sperm combination that produced yours truly, not to mention an award-winning plastic surgeon, a bevy of trainers, fashion consultants, and stylists, he looks about 10 years younger than he actually is. In fact, Harvard Black, or Harry Blumenstein, as I know him, only stopped playing high school students in movies about 2 years ago. He was 26 then. I can't make it out to the rents next weekend. I need you to break it to Mom and Dad, Harvard continues, ignoring my sarcasm. Harvard, you know how they are about Passover. I'm not making excuses for you again. If you want out, you're just going to have to break it to them yourself, I lecture, realizing to my chagrin that if Harvard backs out, there's no way in hell I'm going to be able to avoid the annual family dinner at the Blumenstein Manse. I'm sure they'll understand. They of all people know how unforgiving this industry can be. Miss one party and you're off everyone's radar for good, replies Harvard, before beginning to sing an ear-splittingly off-key rendition of Kanye West's Heartless, along with his XM satellite radio. I roll my eyes and move the phone away from my ear. Harvard's right. My parents are certainly no strangers to the biz. My father, Simon Blumenstein, owns Blum Films, one of the largest film conglomerates of this side of the U.S. He married my mom, former actress model Charlotte Hayes, when she was still a young ingenue trying to break into Hollywood. A young ingenue who, to my father's deep disappointment, had become pregnant with me after dating him for just a few months. Typically, when parents have two children as far apart in age as my brother and I, the younger kid is the accident, the change of life baby, as they say. It's no surprise, to me anyway, that in my family, the situation is reversed. Being the only non-Hollywood inclined member of the Blumenstein clan, my black sheep status was pretty much cemented in stone the day my mother took me to a children's talent agency and was told I just wasn't aesthetically appealing enough for Pampers commercials. I was 1 year old. Given my scholastic aptitude and regular membership in geek squads like the Mathletes and Mad Scientists throughout high school, my father often joked that I was not his own flesh and blood, but rather the accountant's son. Sometimes, I wish that were actually the case. Fine, don't come. I don't really care what you do, but I refuse to... Thanks a million, Jerry. You're the greatest. Listen, I gotta go. I have a meeting with my agent in 5. Ciao, baby. And with that, my brother hangs up on me. I'm about to return the telephone to its cradle and resume work on Candidate 2 when a middle-aged woman, dressed in eye-gougingly hideous neon-orange floral-print dress, approaches my door. The aforementioned woman just so happens to be wearing enough makeup on her mug to pass for one of the killer clowns from outer space. Coincidentally, this is the title of yet another movie you couldn't pay me to see because, in my humble opinion, all clowns, and people or things that look like them, are truly terrifying. This woman is no exception. Crap. Birthday patrol strikes again. You see, I stopped celebrating my birthday at age 21. As far as I'm concerned, once you're old enough to legally drink, There's absolutely nothing to look forward to about getting older except for an AARP membership, collecting Social Security. That is, if the government doesn't manage to fuck that up within the next few years, which it undoubtedly will, and death. So why do I have to take time out of my day to sing and celebrate the impending death of others when I don't even do it for myself? Thinking fast, I cradle the phone closer to my ear and begin having a highly important conversation with the dial tone. President Obama, I'm so happy you chose La Brea as your life insurance provider. I'm completing the paperwork on your policy as we speak, and we'll have it faxed to the White House ASAP, I state loudly in the exaggerated, self-important voice of a morning news anchorman. Out of my peripheral vision, I notice that the killer clown is hovering near my door. When I look up, she is excitedly mouthing the word birthday and emphatically gesturing toward the lounge. I catch her eye and shrug my shoulders in a gesture I hope appears to be sufficiently disappointed. I then mouth "President" to her in reply and gesture toward the phone. She raises her tweezed within an inch of their lives eyebrows in skepticism. Maybe I should have said Vice President instead? But eventually she leaves. I rise from my desk and manage to shut my door, just in time to prevent myself from being deafened by my colleague's ear-splitting, sounds like a dozen cats drowning, rendition of that miserable happy birthday song. American Idols, they most certainly are not. I've barely begun to read Candidate 2's life insurance application when I am once again interrupted, this time by a tentative knock on my office door. "I don't want any cake," I yell out, but the door creaks open empty anyway. "Are you Gerald?" inquires the breathtakingly gorgeous leggy blonde, now standing just feet away from my desk. Amy Seddon is the top salesperson at La Brea, and in my humble estimation, is way too beautiful to be involved in this detestable industry at all, let alone to be conversing with the likes of me. It's no wonder she has no idea who I am, despite the fact that our offices have been three doors down from one another for about 3 years now. To make matters worse, she has an incessantly pleasing personality, which makes her virtually impossible to hate, even for an expert in misanthropy like me. "Unfortunately, yes," I reply, my pulse quickening. I hate when I get like this, all nervous and shy and palm sweaty, as if I needed to make myself more attractive to any more unattractive to this miles out of my league woman. You would think I would have grown out of this by now. I find myself hypnotized by her saucer-like, pale blue eyes, and self-consciously avert my own shit-colored brown ones to shake myself out of the trance. Regrettably, as a result, I wind up staring at her perfectly pert C-cup breasts. If Amy notices my ogling, she does a good job of ignoring it, smiling at me with those pearly whites of hers. "I was just down in Max's office," Amy begins. Max is my boss. "God, I bet she's screwing Max. Lucky bastard. He wants to see you ASAP. I make a makeshift gun with my thumb and forefinger, raise it to my temple, and proceed to blow my brains out. Despite the massive imaginary head wound, I'm still alive. For a few more hours, anyway. I mutter a thanks to Amy, slowly rise from my seat and head for the door. As I pass my goddess coworker, I get a whiff of her French vanilla perfume and strawberry shampoo. It takes every ounce of strength I have to keep myself from getting a visible and highly painful hard-on. "If you don't mind my saying so," she offers, her breath in my ear sending chills down my spine. "He seems a bit pissed at you, so be careful in there, okay?" "Yep, he's definitely fucking her." "I'll try," I manage to respond, my breathing shallow and labored as I move away from Amy and begin the long trek down the hallway to Executive Vice President Maximilian Brentwood IV's corner office. Like every successful old moneyed male in Hollywood, my boss looks like a recently retired Abercrombie and Fitch model. Tan skin, personal trainer body, a full head of hair. He's 3 years younger than me and makes more money per year, not including the inevitable trust fund checks, than I will probably see in a lifetime. Basically, he sucks ass. Though not literally. At least I don't think so. You wanted to see me? I inquire once I'm outside my boss's door. Max is at his desk fiddling with his BlackBerry, which makes him look absolutely ridiculous to me, seeing as his computer is just inches away. He's probably playing one of those video games on it, Sudoku or some shit like that. Come in, he answers, without looking up from his crackberry, as the cool kids call it these days. I enter the office and hover uncomfortably over his desk, shifting my weight from one foot to the other. Over Max's head are his various diplomas. Yale undergrad, Harvard business. Typical. Have a seat, he insists, meeting my eyes for the first time. Reluctantly, I ease myself into one of the uncomfortable, straight-back chairs facing his desk and slump down like a misbehaved child waiting for a scolding. Let me ask you something, Gerald. Do you like working here? Max asks me, his brow furrowed and a show of concern so exaggerated that I'm already updating my resume in my head. I can't imagine doing anything else, I reply honestly. Yes. I think that's part of our problem here, posits Max, as he leans backward in his chair, stroking his chin, an artificial gesture he most certainly learned from dear old Dad. Listen, if you're gonna fire me, just... Max holds up his hand, palm facing outward, interrupting my speech. Gerald, I like you, he offers. My bullshit meter is buzzing off the charts right about now, because... No one likes me. Not really, anyway. Would you if you were them? I didn't think so. You've scored the highest in the company on every actuary exam you've taken. No one here can argue that you aren't good at what you do. And yet, it's come to my attention that you've denied life insurance to every candidate you've reviewed during the past 2 months. Unfortunately, that puts a definite red flag in my book under your name. I mean, how do you expect us to stay in business if we don't issue any policies? With all due respect, sir, I respond. Coincidentally, a phrase I love to use before I say something completely disrespectful. I have not denied every candidate. Oh, Max says, so smug. That elementary school teacher from 2 weeks ago. I definitely approved her policy, I argue resolutely. Gotcha, Max. Ah, yes, the school teacher, Max says, nodding his head. You recommended we charge her the highest allowed premium. Yeah, I thought you'd like that. More money for you, right? Gerald, she's a single mother of two, receiving little to no financial support from her ex-spouse. How did you expect her to pay that type of premium? And why should she have to? The woman is young, she has a clean bill of health, and no family history of terminal illness. Max spouts off with such confidence you would think he analyzed life expectancies for a living. When truthfully, the guy never took a single actuary exam. Do you know how many germs crawl around the public school system? It's like a cesspool that just so happens to house prepubescents, I explain. We charge clients high insurance premiums when they have a family history of cancer, heart conditions, maybe diabetes. Not because they handle too many used tissues on a daily basis, my boss lectures, rubbing his forehead, as if my mere presence gives him a headache. Did you know that tissues... Enough! Max interrupts. I think I know what you need, he says, sliding a business card across the table to me. I take the card, which is black with silver lettering. It reads, Dr. Martin Freenley, psychiatrist, psychotherapist, hypnotist. Available for consultation 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You want me to see a shrink? I spit out the words in disbelief. A licensed therapist, and yes, I think he can help you with your issues, replies my boss. Thanks, but I don't really think that's necessary, I say, pushing the business card back across the desk and rising from my chair. If that's all, I should really get back to work. I'll try not to deny so many applications in the future. As I'm leaving the office, Max calls out after me. You have an appointment for 8 o'clock this evening. I stop dead. There goes those puns again, in my tracks. Excuse me? I made you an appointment with Dr. Friendly for tonight. Are you forcing me to see a therapist? I ask incredulously, my face reddening. You know, legally I can't do that, answers Max pragmatically. No, you can't, I say, as I start to leave again. But if you do not go, I can report to the president of this company, Maximilian Britton with a third, or as Max calls him, Daddy Dearest, that it is my opinion that you are too mentally unstable to continue working here. And that, dear readers, was the moment I decided to go into therapy.